Future of Tech, hosted by Avishai Sharlin, Division President of Amdocs Technology. In this podcast, Avishai sits down with technology leaders and some of the most innovative minds in the industry to learn how they are disrupting the present and what kind of impact they foresee for the future. No topic is off limits, so sit back, relax, and maybe take notes, because what you hear on this show might just be a glimpse into the future. When Owen McCabe started frequenting one specific coffee shop, he noticed something. Not the quality of the coffee, rather he became friendly with the owner of the shop and saw that this man was truly engaged with all of his customers. He knew their names, their preferences. He and that familiarity kept customers coming back, even if he wasn't offering the best deal in the neighborhood. Owen looked at his own company and found that his relationship with his customers was nothing like that. How it was doing outreach was so impersonal and rote. The messages and marketing even bordered on spammy. Owen knew there must be a better way. From there, Intercom was born, with a mission to make internet business personal and create a seamless, direct line between a business and its customers. Intercom's key solution was a business messenger tool that allowed companies to connect with customers through their apps and other digital properties. It was a game changer, but soon enough, the innovation needed to take the next step. On this episode of Future of Tech, Owen, the chairman and co-founder of Intercom, explains how his team at Intercom overcame its initial hesitancy to get into the world of automation and bots in order to level up the company while staying true to its mission. Plus, he discusses how customers are using Intercom technology to find new ways to connect with their consumers, and why he thinks that in the next 10 years, we will see a widespread adoption of automation and conversational technology.
Future of Tech is brought to you by Amdocs Tech. Amdocs Tech is Amdocs' R&D and technology center, paving the way to a better connected future by creating open, innovative, best-in-class products and continuously evolving the way we work, learn, and live. To learn more about Amdocs, visit the Amdocs technology page on LinkedIn.
So Owen, welcome to Future of Tech. Great having you with us.
Yeah, thank you.
And I think the best thing to do is maybe to start at the very early beginning. So you're in Dublin, you just finished college. Why did you go to study technology? How did it all begin?
Yeah, you know, we all have these little stories we tell ourselves that paint a poetic and neat narrative about the past. I'll share mine, but I'm not sure this really fully describes what actually happened. But,
okay. But it's a good story.
So it's a good story. Exactly. So I grew up watching these TV shows. There was two of them. One was called Tomorrow's World. Another was called Beyond 2000. One was based in the UK. One was in Australia. And they were all about this bright, beautiful future. You know, there was a whole episode on flying cars. You know, it was all about how magical everything ahead of us, maybe. Yeah. We don't really think about the future that way anymore. We think about it a little more negatively, but, you know, 30 years ago, the future was bright. Anyway, I watched these shows and I was just enthralled by, you know, the technology and the science and the stories of what could be. There was just something so captivating about that. So captivating. Anyway, through that, I think I decided I wanted to become a scientist, because a lot of the people in these shows, they were scientists. They wore lab coats and they had all these cool equipment, and they would invent all of these futuristic technologies. So I had it in my head I wanted to be a scientist. And so science, for whatever reason, was in my little internal narrative. Then entirely separately, the kids I hung out with on the street all had various computers, different older computers. And we really just played computer games on them. But computers were so interesting and what you could do with them. And I think it was around the year, you know, 1994, when one of the kids in the street got the internet. And the internet was pretty fascinating for kids in Ireland that had no access to the wider world, be able to visit websites and get a sense that you're in contact with somewhere outside of this small place was really incredible. I remember we watched this movie. I forget what the movie's called. Maybe it's called The Mighty Ducks, but it was like a cheesy little kids Disney movie about ice hockey players. And that's a real team. The Mighty Ducks is a real team. And we went to the Mighty Ducks website and it was amazing. Wow, it was a real thing. And it was the closest you'd get for poor Irish kids to be able to visit that part of the world. Anyway, so computers was something that set my imagination on fire. And then as I started to think about what I wanted to do and what I might study in college, I discovered there was a subject called computer science. And I was like, holy shit, got two of them. I don't even have to make a choice.
Yeah.
You know, it's obvious. This is what I need to do. And I went to some of the open days. And of course, when you go to the open days in college, they show you the coolest stuff, all these computer games and 3D stuff and flashing lights. It was very sexy. They don't tell you that actually 90-something percent of it is maths. And, you know, I didn't hate maths, but it wasn't as sexy on a daily basis as they made out to believe, but that's okay. But that's how I ended up doing computer science. And quite frankly, I loved it. It really just, I found it empowering. I really got the sense that back then, and I still think it's the case today, that we were only getting started. So much was still possible.
So, you know, going back in time, do you still find yourself intrigued and enthusiastic when it comes to computers, or the flame kind of went down?
It's a good question. You know, I reminisce quite a bit for the days of GeoCities, MSN Messenger and ICQ and Yahoo chat rooms. Those were the days of innocence.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, they're just silly, nerdy, naive, innocent creativity. It was so cool. And, you know, we're now at a stage in humanity where one thing led to another and the internet now is being blamed for all of the world's wrongs. And so maybe really, or at least in the public narrative, the internet and technology and computers has lost its innocence and wonder. Sometimes I feel a little bit like that myself. You know, you will get a bit of that when you run a high intensity Silicon Valley venture capital backed enterprise software company for 10 years. You'll get a little jaded. But, you know, sometimes I feel a little disconnected from that wonder. Other times, I know that we haven't really come that far. I know that much of what we do with computers and the internet, actually, we've been playing with the fundamentals of those technologies for a long time. I studied computer vision in my computer science course. I started computer science in 2002. And much of what I was playing with in that course is only coming to the world today. You know, I built a little hacky face tracker that it wasn't until a decade or so later that you saw stuff like that in Snapchat, where they started to, you know, find the face and apply filters, et cetera. So we're only starting to commercialize much of those things. But when you look at it over even a couple decades, you see that we haven't come that far. So I'm still quite excited, but I'm excited about using technology in different types of ways. You know, I want to think about how can we apply a lot of the things that we get excited about, or the tools and techniques that we're quite familiar with in our businesses, how can we deliver value to the wider world, not just other technologists? You know, we're solving a lot of our own problems, and that's important, and that makes the world go round, and we're creating great business efficiencies and enabling many people to do brilliant work. But there are 7-odd billion people on the planet that don't benefit from much of the stuff that we build. So there's some of the questions on my mind. How can we bring these tools to the wider world? And I think in answering that question, I think I'll get to connect again with a lot of the wonder I had in the early days of my experiments with technology and the internet.
You mentioned the fact that you were reminiscing. And do you think that there are still people or kids like you in Ireland that, you know, internet was like a huge thing for them in today's world? Are there still phenomena that people, you know, never saw things and are visiting website with the same awe?
I like to think so. You know, you and I live in quite fortunate, you know, environments and societies, but there are a range of places around the world where they don't have much of the things we have. There's developing nations that they're only starting to get online. I like to think that there are kids all over India, perhaps, that in the last 10 years just came online through their phones.
Yeah.
and they are starting to watch American TV shows or listening to American music, and it probably is blowing their mind. You know, they're tapping into that culture.
If it's good or bad, but yeah.
I think it's true. But yeah, for sure. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Maybe bad. But that doesn't mean that it's not very thrilling to them. You know, if you come from a small place, you know, Ireland is a small place and was a smaller place when I grew up in, you know, I guess in the 90s, 80s and 90s. Anything that connects you with the outside can really be quite enlightening and educational and motivating and inspiring new ideas, you know? So I think that, I like to think that's still happening.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. It's the access to information and knowledge that leads you. Yeah. So let's go back into history. You finished college and then what?
I finished college and I remember my last year in college, I could not wait to be done. Oh my God, I was done. And I think part of it was because I had a real desire and thirst to prove myself in the wider world and in the business world. And I wanted to be recognized. I wanted love and validation, all the things a young nerd seeks from the world.
Yeah.
And I spent a lot of college, you know, daydreaming. And I spent a lot of college daydreaming about some of my business heroes. And there was a company back then, they were called 37 Signals. Today, they're called Basecamp. And they're still alive and kicking and thriving. They just launched an amazing product called Hey, new email product. But back then, their big product was called Basecamp, and it was a project management tool. And they had this PDF book called Getting Real, which I printed out on A4 pages on the college printer, which you were absolutely not supposed to do. It's like a stack of like 200 pages. And I would read it on the train going into college, and I had all my little notes on it. And it was all about building a software business and a product business. And so, you know, that became my dream. I think so much of our dreams and our goals, maybe all of our dreams and our goals, are modeled after others. That's what we do. We're copying machines. I don't know if humans really ever do anything wholly original. And so I wanted to do what they did. They started in consulting. And then moved to a product company. And so I started a consulting company too. So straight out of college, I launched that agency. It was called Contrast. You know, another part of the narrative I tell, I think this one is quite true because it stings when I share it. But, you know, I had a couple little jobs when I was 16. They were never real jobs. I was clearing tables at a hotel, for example, for a few weeks. They were disastrous and painful experiences. I could not stand to be told what to do by somebody else. I was very obviously unemployable. And so the whole idea of starting my own company was that I wouldn't have to have a boss. And the joke and story I tell, which I think is true, like I said, and the cruel irony is that when you're consulting, you've 10 bosses, 10 clients. So that was extra difficult, but it was a way to kind of translate my own personal talents and skill into cash. Even if I was on that treadmill where, you know, I stopped earning when I stopped working and there was a direct relationship between the time I spent and my income, it was some form of independence. So that was a pretty cool start. And I then started to work on ways to get out of consulting. And this is the path that 37 Signals took. We built a lot of different products. A lot of people back then, a lot of consulting companies, they talked about a way to earn passive income, is what they said. And this is like that's a real kind of freelancer's view on the world. It's a freelancer's dream.
Yeah.
Earn money and don't do any work.
Yeah.
We built a bunch of different things, most of which I won't bore you about. The one that actually worked was a tool called Exceptional. And it was an exception tracking tool, error tracking tool. When your software, your web application crashed, it would email the developers with all the problems and it would log it in an interface. And it was cool. Big success, used, you know, the world over, thousands of customers, but really quickly we figured out, and I figured out that I had no passion for exception tracking, no passion for developers' tools. And it was an important lesson for me in working on things that really did ignite my and our passion. And so that's the abridged story where I got into computer science because it was a direct pull. It fit my personal narrative. And I wanted to build and invent and make technology, and it gave me the tools for that. I started consulting to escape having a boss, to start earning some cash and realize I had many, many bosses, and started product companies to escape consulting, only to learn that that's only as good as your passion can keep you interested. And that was really then the platform that had us start Intercom. You know, when I had exhausted all of their avenues for happiness, the option on the table was this new company.
Good. So walk us through it. So one night or one day you think about Intercom, and what's the idea behind it? Or what is what's the vision that you thought about when you started it?
You know, at that point, we were running this internet business exceptional. We had thousands of paying customers. It was, like I said, a success. We were no different from other online businesses in the way that we worked. We used email tools and help desks, et cetera, to connect and communicate with them. We started to frequent this local coffee shop. There was a guy called Colin Harmon in Dublin. He brought the first hipster coffee to Ireland. And we would visit him for the coffee, but we'd stay and come back for Colin. He was a cool, friendly guy. He got to know our names. He'd smile when we came in the door. He'd share his passion about coffee and tell us way more about it than we ever wanted to know. But we built a relationship with the guy. And this is the first time I had a relationship with a guy who owned a coffee shop I frequented. And that relationship bred real loyalty. And we came back and we referred friends and we gave him feedback and shared the things we were excited about. Any mistakes were no big deal. We definitely paid more. And he had everything any business would want. It was so interesting then to compare our online business, exceptional, and all of our peers with this simple coffee shop, and realized he was night and day ahead of all of us when it came to customer relationship. He had real contact and genuine interaction with his customer base. We had none of these things. And so we started to look at our tools, the email marketing products and the help desks and the live chat products, and they were transactional and they were difficult to really know who you were talking to and, you know, give them the time of day and respect that they deserved, where Colin could smile and exchange pleasantries and get to know our faces and our preferences. We with our customers were spammy, fake, pretty cold, and it was all because we were hidden behind these tools, trapped. So we started to ask ourselves, you know, is this just an inherent trade-off with online business? In return for the great benefits from selling online and selling around the clock, will you just never get to know your customers? Will you never get to connect with them? Or has the internet in its infancy just not caught up with how we want to work? You know, like I said early on, how I really felt that, you know, decades ago we were in the early days, and still today I think that's quite the case. Especially then it felt that the way in which we worked with our customers online was just so rudimentary, so basic, and provided a crappy experience for the customer and really trapped the business and the great creative people that ran them. Everyone lost. And so with Intercom, we set out to solve this, to create one simple, seamless, direct line between the business and the customer, and provide them a way finally to have a relationship with them. We said our mission was to make internet business personal. We saw internet business as being egregiously impersonal. And the thing we landed on as a central and core solution to this was the messenger. We launched a messenger in the same 12 months that Facebook Messenger, WhatsApp, Snapchat, and half a dozen others launched. The difference between ours and theirs was that we built a business messenger. It wasn't for consumers, it was for online companies. We let people put the messenger in their site or on their mobile app. Mm-hmm. And that simple innovation led to everything that came after. It was the first time when business people really felt they could reach out and connect with people in their apps, and that in the opposite fashion, customers really could get to know the people they were doing business with. And it was a subtle paradigm shift that you now see the ripples of absolutely everywhere. And that eventually became what we now today describe as conversational commerce, conversational marketing, conversational platforms, a conversational approach to online business. And we're now at a place where, you know, we've long been saying that all businesses will become internet businesses. And of course, in the last 6 months and with this global health crisis, we've seen that accelerate. We're certain now that as every business comes online, the primary means and mode by which they will connect with customers will be messengers. It will be the things that people are familiar with and comfortable with that they like to use with their friends. And that's a trend, again, we're really only in the early innings of.
You had a mission which is quite clear. I think the message overall is also very clear and resonate. But the question I have, okay, so the world grew also to understand that this is something everybody wants. So what's the difference between, you know, 10 years ago it was freshy, but today is like, come on, everyone is doing it. And you mentioned, you know, only several of the names that you mentioned, they have also maybe kind of a B2B version. So where did you evolve into, or how did you evolve to make sure that you're still relevant in this domain?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think, you know, in the first 5 years, we're, you know, this is our 10th year working on Intercom. In the first 5 years, we were way ahead of the pack, arguably a little early in the space. We had started to build for small businesses, teeny tiny companies. You know, these were folks that they just had the freedom and flexibility that the bigger organizations didn't have. They could play with silly tools like ours, but it took a good 5 years to really turn the toy that we built into an actual business application. There was a lot of promise in those first years, and we had a lot of customers and tremendous revenue growth. But in reality, when customers got bigger, the various roadblocks you hit when you're using a fledgling technology. Again, the first 5 years, we were out ahead of the rest, and we were, you know, arguably a year too early. We were really just settling into figuring out, will businesses really use messengers, to put it bluntly, right? Does the conversational thing make sense? So there wasn't much competition at the start. In the next 5 years, I think people started to realize, okay, conversational is a thing. And you had everyone like the big public companies like Zendesk and many others start to build, you know, Intercom-like interfaces and things, you know, very closely inspired by what we built, if not direct copies of what we built. And that, like any company in a kind of a disruptive cycle, require that we innovated again in a great way. And there was so much innovation in the early days. I mean, so much invention in any given year. But again, that was really in service of making the conversational thing and the messenger thing work. I would say the latter 5 years then started to be defined by automation. Our mission being making internet business personal kind of shut our eyes to automation and bots. It became a form of dogma. It became a religion. Blinkers. You know, we were all about bringing humans back into the mix. We were fighting much of the spammy, transactional, crappy experiences that all of the other tools use, the email marketing products and the help desk products that were designed to sometimes make it difficult to reach out to businesses or to keep customers and businesses at a distance. And so we at the start thought that automation and bots were really the opposite of what we needed to invest in. How could they be personal? You know, as you and I both know, AI and machine learning started slowly to become a thing. Now, how much of a thing it is, you know, a big open question. If it's 80% marketing, is it 90% marketing? Is it 99% marketing? But it's true to say that automation has been happening in technology and business software at large, and finally has started to become useful. We started to see demand for things like bots. We started to see people play with bots, chat bots. And it became clear that if we didn't actually invest in these things ourselves, that not only would we get left behind, but our mission to make internet business personal would be at risk, because we didn't actually believe that others who invested in bots and automation without that mission would not actually make matters worse, would not actually make it more spammy and crappy. So we started to build bots. We had bots that were kind of pre-made that would just do simple things, collect email addresses and, you know, grease the wheels, move customers along. You know, 90% of the functionality we provided was to be run by humans inside our customers' businesses. Then over time, we built products like custom bots where you could program your own bot. So, you know, you could have bots on certain pages of your site. And if people came back some certain times, or if they were from a certain country or meet certain criteria, you could ask them different questions or offer them calls or ask to make contact with them, et cetera, or for onboarding customers, et cetera. You could build your own bot. Then eventually we built a thing called Resolution Bot, which relies on machine learning, which learns from the humans inside your customers' businesses. And then we really started to see the value for our customers. We really saw an opportunity to further our mission, because what it allowed us to do was help consumers receive quite friendly service, even if it was automated, but it was timely and accurate. And we found it to be quite impersonal, the experience that a lot of people had, even if they were, if they got to talk with customer support reps, if they were asked to wait a whole day, didn't really respect their individual and personal time and priorities. So we expanded our vision and said that bots could actually help customers be more personal with theirs by providing quicker service, more accurate answers, and allowing then the humans to work in the higher level problems. And that really is what Resolution Bot does. When you install it, it learns from your customer support reps. Then it automatically starts to answer a lot of the common questions before it gets to the customer support reps. The net effect being that your customers get quicker response times. Typically, it'll decrease response time by about 44%. And then your customer support reps can focus on the stuff the bots won't do well. So that has been a game changer for us. And I think we're still also early there too. But the mix between conversational interfaces and intelligent and tasteful use of bots and automation has been a big, big win for the mutual benefit of consumers and online businesses.
So in that sense, technology played a very important role in the making of or the maturing your solution. How do you see it forward looking? Do you still see technology as a key differentiator, or is it something that becoming a commodity?
It's a good question. I mean, all technology that I've ever studied becomes a commodity, becomes commodified, becomes generic, becomes just broadly and widely available. Potentially, that's happening sooner and quicker today than it did 10 or 15, 20 years ago. I don't know if that's true. Kind of feels true. There's just a lot more people in the technology industry, and we have a lot more flexible tools to play with. So things are accelerating. There are very few technology companies that can afford to stop innovating. There are zero technology companies that will ever admit that they've stopped innovating. But there are very few, I think, that really can afford to just hit pause. That said, it is true to say that if you're selling to large, very large enterprise businesses, you work on a longer time scale. And much of the value you often provide is helping them implement your technology and make it work with their legacy systems and inside their organizations. And as such, actually, a lot of what you're paid for isn't rapid innovation. We sell to kind of mid-market, middle-sized businesses. We sell to enterprises also, but we're still actively moving up market. And as such, we are required to innovate at a quicker pace. But I think also the particular space that we're in, we're on the kind of bleeding edge of consumer interaction and engagement. It demands a lot of innovation.
So who would be your typical customer?
Yeah, you know, it's any online business. It's conventionally software businesses. We get a lot of consumer businesses too who have mobile apps. And then we get a lot of e-commerce companies also, but it's really any online business. But what I was saying is that they're using Intercom to get an edge over their competitors. They're using Intercom in new and innovative ways. They're trying to stand out with their customers. And as such, they are buying for innovation. So innovation and new technology is fundamental and key.
So let's assume I'm such a customer. I just browse the website. So, you know, the material, it looks very nice. I would like to start. What's the first thing that they do?
You know, it's pretty straightforward. You can install it yourself.
Okay.
A lot of people, they will install it in like their local environment and they'll play with it. A lot of people, they will kind of communicate with their colleagues and teammates. It's the type of product that affords play and experimentation. It's quite pliable that way. Quite tactile. You know, a lot of the things we build are quite visual. You know, we launched recently this new visual builder that lets you automate sequences of messages, and it's a drag and drop interface with arrows. So you know, you'll install it yourself, but you'll play with it.
Okay.
You know, you'll experiment quite a bit. And in doing so, then you'll start to imagine what may be possible. It's a great tool for creatives. And by creatives, I mean people that are creative within support or marketing teams, sales teams, who are trying to find new and engaging ways to connect with customers. So just using the damn thing is a great way to start.
And if such a customer finds, quote unquote, a new way or a new use case, how mm-hmm. would you know about it?
We, in some ways that are not so great, and I'll mention in a second, we use our product extensively internally in so many different ways. Like our IT team, for example, if you need to file a ticket or something's wrong with your machine or internet connection, you'll need to contact them through Intercom, and you'll go through the bots and, you know, all that interface. They've done a good job of making sure that they only have to talk to you if it's a real problem. That's a problem for IT. A lot of the problems that they have to fix are pretty damn repetitive. So that's an example of how we aggressively use it inside Intercom. The dark side, like I mentioned, is that we hack it and we're kind of blind to our customers' problems. We just use it in these most egregious, crazy ways that we miss it. I say all that to explain that a lot of these novel ways are invented by a lot of the teams inside Intercom, teams that don't actually work on the product. Say a bunch of our different marketing teams will use Intercom in pretty cool ways. We also contribute a lot of content to the industry. We have multiple podcasts. We've written many books. We like publish very, very frequently on our blog. And these create conversations with people and we get feedback from people. A lot of our content will often propose ways of using Intercom and people will tell us what does or doesn't work. So there's a kind of an ongoing dialogue. We also have, you know, account managers and engineers on the sales team that will partner with the bigger companies to help them get things done. And they'll bring things back to the engineering and product teams. A lot of what we've had to do organizationally inside Intercom as we've grown and started to sell to bigger customers is to connect the sales and marketing teams with our product teams. You know, it used to be the case that the product and engineering teams could go off on their own and daydream and invent the future and frankly not listen to customers. And you can kind of do that at large when you're selling to like many, many, many types of small customers. You know, your opinion counts more than anything else. But when you start to sell to larger enterprises that have specific needs and goals and ways of working, it's important to listen to them. So it's been this big cultural evolution where we've created many different forums to listen to our customers. And that's how we learn about this innovation, which then gets fed into our product and our marketing and our sales, where we can share at large how some customers are using us in cool, novel ways.
So how do you see the future evolve in terms of, you know, the next 5 years? Technology, as you said, is being commoditized as we speak. You need to innovate to survive. So where is the market heading?
You know, one of the things that's fascinating to be in the driver's seat, if not the front row seat, for a big technology evolutionary shift, to be someone who creates a trend like we did, this conversational stuff, and then to watch that be adopted in the market at large, is to actually visceral sense of just how slow adoption really is. You know, for people like you and I, technology nerds, in this business, inventing and building the future, you know, we get jaded. We've seen these things. I mentioned that much of the computer vision innovation that, for example, we see being applied in great technical ways in self-driving cars, for example, people have been playing with that for 20 years inside the universities. It's just amazing to see how slow adoption really is. And so we, within conversational technologies, are really only crossing the chasm, if you will, now. We're really only now starting to sell to the mainstream. And, you know, we have hundreds of customers in the Fortune 500. We sell to all of the greatest internet and technology brands. But even within those customers, they're still using conversational stuff in some smaller ways. For sure, there's big brands. You know, I'll visit some big brands online, you know, really, really big brands, you know, Fortune 50 companies, and see them use Intercom on their homepage, which blows my mind. So there's big, big brands using us in big, full ways. But often you'll see people, they'll dip their toe in the water. They'll use it in one team. They'll use it within one part of the life cycle. And that's the way all technology gets adopted. It's a really cool thing. And you often see it spread from that one place into multiple teams. But I say all that to explain that actually the next 10 years is just going to see the wide, wide adoption of conversational technologies. Now, that's not a very interesting answer, but that's like, you know, 80% of it. That said, what we're going to see is be increasingly practically useful. Today, it can be a little bit annoying. I'll be the first to admit. I'm so frustrated these days visiting websites where I'm clicking, accepting cookies, and I'm trying to close banners that want my email address for newsletters, and I'm trying to close ads. And once and again, I'm trying to close an intercom bot that's trying to come up and get my attention. And that's an interesting experience. And so, you know, we have a responsibility at Intercom and in the industry to make sure that these automation tools and technologies are not annoying, are not frustrating, don't get in people's way, actually are deeply beneficial, are welcomed and wanted by the consumer. They need to be of deep mutual benefit. We need to get to a place where when a customer opens a site and they see one of these things, they say, great. And you see that on Twitter a lot. You'll see a lot of people say, oh, when I sign up for a service and I see they're using Intercom, I know I'm in good hands. But I think there are plenty of people also that get pissed off by some of these tools and the way that they're used. So just making it useful and greasing the wheels. And a lot of that is in both the interface, but also the automation. The automation stuff is early days for everybody. You know, it's still a novel, but we will get to a place in, you know, 10 years, maybe five, a little, where, you know, these bots will be able to carry real conversations and solve real problems. We can do it today with Resolution Bot, but it's still just a, you know, sometimes it's up to a third of inbound inquiries, but, you know, we'll see a day where this could be the vast majority of inquiries. Anytime you reach out to a customer, you're talking to a bot and you're happy to do it. So that's going to be a big part of the future. And then the last thing I would say is that, you know, I've already talked about widespread adoption, just more customers and companies using it in big places. I've talked about ease of use and people being happy to use these things rather than sometimes being annoying. I've talked about like broad automation where people are really excited to talk to these bots because they really know what they're talking about, these bots. I think then the last piece is kind of multi-channel and these things being everywhere and being a little less visible. Still today, there's some hoops to jump through to talk to a company and as a customer. You know, you'll speak through the intercom messenger and maybe you'll get a follow-up email and that's all fine, but you know, we will get to a place where you can use iMessage and WhatsApp and all of these messengers, and you can kind of seamlessly interact with these businesses and brands, with people and with bots, maybe even as a team, without having to use these third-party messengers and tools or emails. And it'll just be substantially more straightforward. You know, today people don't really want brands in their personal messengers, but if the brands had the technology and the know-how and the kind of processes and culture to work in a way that respected the customer, then you would see, I think, a lot more comfort with people letting brands into their messengers. You know, if you wanted to text me to coordinate about this podcast, I would have no problem giving you my number because I know you're not going to text me in a week to try and advertise your new product. You know, I trust you. And so these tools, well, we'll see. We'll see what happens in a week. But these tools will need to build that trust, and they will be able to do that in the future too. And if you take a step back, all of that will see an acceleration of that mission to make internet business more personal. Today, it's not personal. It can be sometimes exploitative, transactional, spammy, fake, create just not nice experiences. And I think through technology and innovation and the smart application of these tools, we're going to see that change substantially for everyone's benefit.
Very interesting. And from an organizational perspective, how do you keep your people innovative? How do you push them to think about, you know, the next thing and to bring you new, fresh ideas?
Yeah, I think, you know, part of it is that you need to celebrate it as a culture. Yeah, from the very start, we would do these weekly show and tell sessions where everyone in the company would tune in on a Friday and you would demo what you had built that week. And so there was a lot of personal pride and excitement and shared celebration around building and innovating. You know, the things that would get the most applause and the most kudos from the company were things that kind of blew people's mind a little bit, excited them, that were innovative, right? And so that's a really big part of it. Celebrating innovation, applauding that thing. You can celebrate so many different types of things. You know, within a sales team, you need to celebrate deals and deal value. That's how you motivate that culture. At large, in a technology company within R&D organizations, you need to celebrate that thing that you want. That's a really, really big part of it. I think the other part that we had was that, you know, the founders and the leaders were quite technology and product oriented. You know, as I've explained earlier, I have a computer science and technology background. I myself love innovation and invention. And when people work at a company where the leaders, the CEO, the people making the decisions, they themselves are clearly inspired and motivated and driven by invention and the creation of new things, that will attract people to the company that want to work there, that will inspire and motivate them, and it will align everyone around the values of their leaders. People want to work for people and be led by people whose principles and values they believe in. And so if your own principles and values are those that espouse creativity, you'll attract those types of people too. So these are some of the softer things that are really, really crucial in from a cultural standpoint.
Great. And on a personal level, you just came back from 10 years in San Francisco. You're now back to Dublin. So what next?
It's a good question. I founded the company as CEO and I moved to chairman three months ago. It was part of my personal plan that I had been thinking about for the last, you know, maybe 4 years. When I hired our COO, Karen, 3 years ago, I told her my dream would be that she would become CEO, and she eventually did. We were able to make that happen. I couldn't be more passionate about what we're doing at Intercom and what we're about to do next. This next year, we're about to ship some really crazy stuff that, you know, just keeps me personally excited. And at the same time, I have some personal goals and missions that, you know, I need to make space for. And one of the lessons you learn as you get a little older is you can't have it all and you can't do it all. And prioritization is just crucial and key. And so this next phase for me is about making space for some of those new things. And I have some dreams and goals, but it's a little early for that. But the first step is, you know, get some perspective and a little bit of rest. And you'd be surprised how long that can take. I'm three months out of the role, and while I'm starting to get excited, really excited about new things, I'll need a few more 3 months, I think, before I get going on something new.
Great. So, Anne, I want to thank you for the time and for sharing the experience and all the thoughts. And any closing comments or topics you would like to cover before we say goodbye?
Yeah, well, I will say thank you for having me, and thank you for those questions. And as you ask about kind of my story there, because I don't dwell often on my story, it's not often that you kind of really are asked to summarize that period of time. That's a good 20 years, maybe. But I would say to people who are listening, technologists and people who like to build and create, and especially those who have kind of entrepreneurial dreams or ambitions to do their own thing, please just know that, you know, building things you think are cool actually is a brilliant strategy for success. And don't let anybody tell you otherwise. If you think it's really, really cool, there's probably other people that do too, because that was the story to my success.
Perfect. It's a great lesson and a great place to end this chapter. And thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much. My pleasure. Thank you.
Bye-bye. See you soon.
Yeah, take care.
Thanks for listening to Future of Tech. If you like what you heard and want more, make sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. And if you have any comments or questions, feel free to write to our host, Avishai Sharlin, directly on LinkedIn.